lineouts, racks.
Pulls, engage.
What an amazing try.
Tries and tackles, dissected by South Africa's top rugby minds. This is To The Last Drop, your weekly in-depth rugby podcast with Liam Delcombe and Brendan Nell.
One of those in-between weeks, the Boks are in Jersey on an island which is preparing them for the lovely weather of Scotland. Apparently, they're having a very nice time at a very nice resort preparing for the tour. But it's in one of those in-between weeks where there's no actual rugby being played. But we've got somebody special on the show.
We do, yeah. It is a bit of a weird week. As much as we tell people that rugby is this thing that goes on for 52 weeks, it's nonstop. The train doesn't ever grind to a halt. This is a weird one in that there is a week where there's nothing. But it's a bit of a build-up to November, a big, big rugby month. So while there is a bit of a lull this week, please know that there's something, there's a big month ahead of us. And in terms of our guest, we thought it was a good time to get one of the heavy hitters in South African rugby onto our show to answer a couple of awkward, if not difficult, questions that's been really part of South African rugby landscape the last couple of months. So SA Rugby's Chief Executive, Rian Ober, also kindly agreed to come onto our show, and he's going to have a chat with us shortly.
Just to put a caveat here, we did also, when we spoke about the equity deal, Liam and I did reach out to the other side, to some of the provinces who, and I think we've said this in the previous pod as well, that opposed the deal at the moment, and asked them if they wanted to come on and put their side. They declined, but we thought let's go straight and ask Rian straight out about it. There are obviously a couple of caveats. There are non-disclosure agreements, and there are, you know, certain things he couldn't talk about. But I think we did get quite a bit out of him. So I think have a listen, and then you'll see for yourself.
With us today is a special guest, a man who has vast experience in the field of administration. In fact, he's had a couple of bites at the cherry, as it were, in South African rugby administration. Not just South Africa, but abroad as well. Rian, it started a very long time ago for you. You called Sydney home for a while, didn't you?
I did indeed, yeah. I was the CEO of Sansar at the time, so not a long period of time. I was there for about a year and then came back to South Africa.
Good groundwork done, though for a competition that did South Africa a good service for a good number of years.
And that was the first iteration of the Super Rugby, Super 12 at the time, that I was the CEO of before I came back to join SA Rugby.
And now, Rian, you had your second round with SA Rugby. I'm sure you thought you saw everything in your first round where, back in the 90s, where they were quite... It was quite turbulent times at times then for SA Rugby, but you've certainly had more than your fair share of situations to handle this time around.
I think what was challenging the first time around is was just rugby just became professional, and rugby wasn't prepared for professionalism at the time, not only in South Africa, but across the board, where we now had to put professional structures in place while we were still mostly an amateur administered sport. And I think if we had a bit more time to prepare, I think the outcome would have been a bit different. And the situation we are in now, 20 years later, might have been a bit different as well. So we still are in the situation of trying to run a professional sport. And again, I'm saying not South Africa, only across the board. But while we have also some community rugby structures and amateur structures that need to be taken into consideration as well as part of delivering the professional side of the sport.
Is it just simply a case of the amateur structures as it existed, the tentacles go so far and wide that it's almost, well, not almost, that it is difficult to move on? Or do you think rugby has attracted a new breed of person maybe in administration that maybe in some ways still applies the handbrake?
No, I don't think that is fair. I think what we all have to understand is the DNA of rugby. What is the DNA of rugby? And if we look at South African rugby, the DNA is in the community game. It is in our schools. It is in our club structures. Yeah. It is in our provincial structure. So we can't do away with that. So we can't wish away the community game and only concentrate on the professional game. So it is not possible to have a structure where you only cater for the professional side of the game, but you do not look at the community side of the game. And I think that is the challenge, because, as it was called, amateur rugby at the time, and we preferred to talk about community rugby. It's got its own challenges, and it's got its own structure that it needs to be in place for it to operate successfully. However, the professional game needs its own structures as well. They need a different mindset and skill set to run the professional game. So to balance the two has always been a challenge, and it will always be a challenge.
Has that become easier, finding that balance? I mean, if you think back of, say, the late 90s, I know this is putting you a little bit on the spot, but...
It is still challenging. It is still challenging. And we really thought with the equity deal that we were planning to put in place, it will assist with that, where you will have an organization that concentrates on the commercial side and commercializing the game, while SC Rugby can concentrate on the business of rugby. So that is one of the reasons why SC Rugby decided in 2019 to start looking at an equity partner to assist them.
I was going to say, Ram, part of that, I mean, the challenge, and we all know back when rugby went professional, part of the problem was that everybody wanted to be professional. And now we're talking about all 14 unions, the smaller unions, clubs started playing players, et cetera. And that obviously wasn't sustainable. We saw that as rugby went on. And now we're sitting with a situation with, you know, four franchises playing in the United Rugby Championship, a couple of other franchises who are there and thereabouts. Professional, and then a bunch of semi-professional teams as such. I mean, you sit in those meetings more than us. Obviously, we hear here and there from people. But has that mindset on the outside of the professional rugby understood the limitations of what amateur rugby can be? Do you still feel that there's a bit of a mindset there that they almost want to be professional as well?
I think they all want to have a competition in which they can play. And I think they all want a competition in which they can play that will allow them to contract players to play in the competitions. We also must be careful to think that we can only have four professional teams in South Africa. The player drain will be so much bigger. We already have a huge outflow of players into America. If you can just go and do your homework, do it. I think there's nearly 100 players playing in America. There's I love a lot of players in France in the second division and even the third division, and now players are in Russia as well. So the South Africa, because of our talent pool and our massive community structures, we produce a lot of players that want to play and they all see themselves to be professionals. Can we put the structure in place where we can accommodate a majority of them? I think yes. I think we have to look at the number of professional players we have. We have to look at the salaries and salary caps. Those are things that we need to start talking to each other about again. And a very important part of professionalism that we have not really grasped in the rugby yet is the transfer system, where clubs get compensated for the development of players, and or when you want to buy my player, I can transfer him. So a player becomes an asset instead of a liability. At this moment in time, players are liabilities in South Africa, rugby, not assets. So the quicker we can have a proper transfer system in place, similar to what they do in football, for example, the quicker we will resolve a lot of our other problems. With players is coming from smaller unions, move to a big union, and there's no compensation for the smaller union. And or South African teams that get South African players that get contracted for international teams in France and Japan, for example, and the local provinces get no compensation for that. So I think those are the type of issues that we still grapple with 20 years after professionalism.
A few years ago, Riyad, and this was kind of foisted upon rugby because of the pandemic and other things, South Africa had to trim the number of professional players that it had in its ranks. What would the ideal number be? I mean, is it... I know we now a few years post the pandemic, but do we need to widen that pool slightly? Because that has to be backed up with solid financials. Are we there yet, or are we close to that?
I think what we first have to do is to understand what is your competition structure and what competitions can we afford to support? How many teams can play in on an international stage, such as a URC competition, for example? So if that is four, what do we do with the others? That is why it was so important for us to fix the Currie Cup, because the Currie Cup was broken and we had to fix it. And I think last year we started on a process to get the Currie Cup back to the status it had. And I think we can even improve on it a bit more, where we can put the structure in place as it is now, where the where the top 8 teams in South Africa participate in the Currie Cup. So that just gives you another level of competition where we can contract players in. Once we've got this, the competition structure sorted, then we have to sit around the table and agree on the number of players that we need to participate in these competitions. So just to say that we have to have 600 or 700 professional players, we do that without looking at the science of the competitions we play in, player welfare, player workload, etc. That all need to be taken into account. And we sit around a table and say, okay, if you play in the Currie Cup competition, your squad can be X. If you play in Currie Cup and URC, your squad size can be Y. Once we've done that, Liam, we'll only then be in a position to really determine how many professional rugby players we need in South Africa.
I really want to just latch on to that. One of the things, I suppose, that works against you in that is the thing that I call the Loch Ness Monster of rugby, the thing we never see, is the global season. World Rugby's been talking about that for decades now, and they never get it. And I know there's vested interests that don't want to move, et cetera. But that's part of the problem that you have with the Currie Cup and finding a slot for the Currie Cup. And we've seen, obviously, the my players and all the arbitration that went on to get players rest before this last Currie Cup. Are you closer to finding a permanent slot for the Currie Cup? And is there any light in the horizon on the global season?
Yeah, okay, let's start with the global season. As you said, is the thing that's been around for a long time. I remember 20 years ago we spoke about a global season. And that will definitely resolve a lot of challenges, not only for South Africa, but for world rugby, for player welfare, rest periods. Again, on an international scale, self-interest plays a role again. And who's going to shift and who's not going to shift? And our Six Nations said, we're not going to shift our competition. That just put fuel on the fire for the South to say, well, if they don't want to shift a few weeks, why must we shift the rugby championships? So, yeah, there's continuous conversations about that. But it feels that we're not going forward really with that. So, okay, now, then we have to find another solution as South African rugby. So what we've done, Brendan, is to, with our members, agree on one rugby season. Up to now, we've played in two different seasons. South Africa played in the traditional Southern Hemisphere winter season, and our URC teams played in the Northern Hemisphere season. Now, that's where you had a clash in your competitions and you couldn't fit everything in. If we all now playing in the same season and we decide, okay, professional rugby or senior rugby in South Africa is going to now run at the same as the URC season runs, then we have at the end of it an open window where we can play Currie Cup without any clashes. And some of our URC teams can see that as preparation for the new URC season. So now that decision has been made, it will now be for us be able as from the next year season to fit in a Currie Cup that is in its standalone window. I think we are quite far down the line to create one season at least in South Africa. And where all our competitions can have its slot without interference from other competitions.
And when you say the Currie Cup will have a standalone slot, are we talking a proper sort of double round in which we have where everybody, the competition's integrity cannot be questioned and the sponsors will be happy?
No, what we are trying to do is to give everybody an opportunity to qualify. So the 4 URC teams will automatically qualify for the Currie Cup. And then the other 10 teams will play in an SA Cup competition, single or double round. At this moment, it's a single round. We are talking about a double round. Finances allow it to be a double round. And then that will mean that some of your smaller unions will now be able to contract players for 12 months. And it will just give some more stability to the players that play in the SA Cup, in the Currie Cup. The top 4 teams out of the SA Cup will then qualify for the Currie Cup. 8 teams in the Currie Cup, single round, semis and final.
Rian, we've also heard like Frans Steyn at the Cheetahs talk about maybe for those other teams going back into a Southern Hemisphere competition of some sort. Is there any light on the horizon on that one?
There's talks, but it's going to be very difficult. In informal discussions that we had, and the travel of the cost, the travel costs that's and accommodation that goes with it. The only way that can work potentially is, but that will mean our teams must base themselves in Australia. Now, what benefit is there then really for the team and its supporters if the team sits in Perth or in Melbourne? And there's no local competition for them back in South Africa. So it is something that is talked about. The chances of that happening is slim.
Mm-hmm. Now, the topic that we spoke about very briefly at the front, that we kind of have to tiptoe around, but that we can't avoid, is the one about the equity deal. Can you give us an idea of where you're at? Can you give us an idea of what SA Rugby's strategy would be given the current situation it finds itself in? Because it's clear now that not everybody is on board.
No, I think we must just go back in history and decide, why did SA Rugby decide to embark on a equity deal? It was that we were for that. Mostly two reasons. First of all, we had break-even business for many years. We never made a profit. Although our income streams increase, we still have no profit. We have no reserve fund. And then that was the thought at the time in 2019, let's have a reserve fund. If anything goes wrong, we at least have some money. COVID came, the little money there was is gone. Everybody took advances from World Rugby. And then SA Rugby decided, well, the most important aspect of the equity deal is to have an investor that will put money into the rugby that will allow us to have a reserve fund, but will also have money available to release to our members. However, in the discussions we had, we also realized that the cash injection is not the only solution to our problems. We also need to have somebody that will assist us through their investment to grow our brand on an international scale. If you look at where we are compared to New Zealand, for example, and or France and England, when it comes to commercial generation of income and revenue commercially, we are so far behind the others. So we need to take our brand outside of South Africa as well. New Zealand has done that successfully. And as you can see, you look at their jersey, they have no South Africa, no New Zealand team as a sponsor. They're an international brand now. And we envisage ourselves to be one as well. We're an international brand on the field. We're one of the best on the field, but off the field, we are probably fourth or fifth in the pecking order. So we were looking for an investor that not only can give us a cash injection in our business and to assist us to have a reserve fund, but also one that with its expertise and its context in professional sport can assist us to take our brand to a much broader base than what we have at this moment in time. So those were the reasons why we entered into an equity deal. But right from the start, Liam, it was always said that it is for the members to decide whether they want to accept the deal or not. We got an instruction of management to negotiate with the athlete group to bring a deal to the table for the general counsel to decide on. The general counsel must now decide what they want to do. Obviously, you will have pros, you'll have those as for the deal. They're so against the deal. Let us sit down, thrash it out, and hopefully come to a position on the 6th of December where all uncertainties have been dealt with, all questions have been answered, and SA Rugby can take a decision that's in the best interest of the whole rugby economy, and maybe not only a few that might not be so comfortable with the deal.
Ryan, I was going to ask you, because there's been obviously a lot of opinions, there's been a lot of financial journalists have suddenly weighed in on this deal, etc. And I'm sure you've seen all those. I know you guys have addressed some of them. And what is the consequences if you guys don't get to a deal on the 6th of December? Obviously, it takes away a lot of the leverage you have in going back to the market for a deal, I'm sure. But how catastrophic would it be if you guys can't sort something out?
Not catastrophic, Brennan. We will still continue to do business. There will just in the short term be less money available to be distributed across the board of rugby. We will have to work harder to start generating more income. As I said, we are a barely break even business at this moment in time. Staying a barely break even business is then going to be our future for the next few years until we can get something else or a different investment. So, yeah, it's going to be challenging, but it is definitely not going to be catastrophic.
Do you feel...
Rihanna, Bendit mentioned a moment ago, financial journalists sort of rolled up their sleeves at this story as well. And one of the sort of themes that has developed is often there are questions asked about your potential partners. Can you just give us a sense of why SA Rugby decided that these guys are the guys, we are happy with what they stand for, and what they offer and where they can take the brand?
Well, we had two firm offers, a lot of interest, two firm offers in the end in December 2023. The one was CVC and the one was the Ackerley Group. What made the Ackerley Group more attractive for us is the fact that they are invested in sport. They are invested in commercialization of the sport. They have relationships with major players in sport, such as the 49ers Enterprises, who's the owner of the San Francisco 49ers. Together they own Leeds United. So irrespective of what certain journalists said, they have a track record in sport, and they have a track record and contacts with those that have been in professional sport for many years. I mentioned the example of the San Francisco 49ers, who is probably one of the top professional football teams, but also brands in the world. But not only off the field, which they can assist us with, but what can they do for us on the field? Imagine we can send out coaching staff for a 10, 14-day period of time to spend time with the San Francisco 49ers to see how they deal with high performance. What can we learn there? What can we bring back to South Africa? So it's not only what we can do off the field, it is also what we can do on the field. So if you just look at that relationship that they have with the 49ers, and the 49ers Enterprises being one of the investors with the Ackerley Group in the consortium, I think that just showed us that we are on the right track when we're talking to the right people.
Ryan, I was just going to put it, we talk about all these sort of journalists and people who've come up that say this is a bad deal. I'm going to put it bluntly. Do you feel it is a bad deal that's being put forth?
Surely, Brendan, if you felt it's a bad deal, why will I take it to South African brand? So surely if I can't tell you that it is a good deal, then I mustn't take it to them. So yeah, that is, we've dealt with this now for a long period of time. We dealt with the people. We do believe that this is a good deal for South African rugby.
Fair enough.
Just in terms of the deal, and this is the only question I'm going to ask you about the deal. Often it's also said that it is, you don't have to drill down into all the nitty-gritty, but it is often said that what the potentially investors are offering is a loan. You have tried to debunk that.
Yeah, because if it's a loan, it means you have to repay the money somehow or another. Remember, they are paying us $75 million for a 20% stake in a company still to be established. There's no limitations on the money. They pay us the money and we don't have to repay that. That is the first aspect that we must remember. If it was a loan, we had to repay that money over a period of time. How do they get their money back? Because we aren't going to give them the 1.4 billion rand back. So how do they get the money back? They have to bring new money into the system for them to claw back their investment. They cannot do that until they have serviced the budget of running rugby in South Africa. So there's a consolidated budget that has been agreed upon, which is the first money that goes into the new company, it flows right into SA Rugby's pockets to pay for the business of rugby in South Africa, which includes our distribution to our unions, our teams, all our programs that we are running for rugby in South Africa. Once they make 1 rand more than that budget, then only do they start sharing in the upside. So if they don't make any more money than what we need to run rugby, they cannot get their money back. So it is in their best interest to ensure that the value of our business becomes so much that they can earn their money back. And then remember, we share 20% in it until they have through the program with their money back, and then we swap around and we get 80% and they get 20% again. So there's no, it is not a loan. You know, you don't go to a bank where you get a loan and you never have to give the money back. We're getting money from them. It's not a loan. We don't have to give it back to them. They have to earn their money back through the commercial program.
Rihanna, I think we're also going to move on because I suppose we could sit here for an hour talking about these and these things you guys are going to have to sort out behind closed doors. It's probably easier to talk once all those discussions in your meetings are sorted out. I know that there's limitations. Just on URC, I think the one consensus, well, I think most people will agree, is that the URC has worked well for South Africa. We've had finalists in all three finals. We've seen a lot of South African players coming back to play for the franchises here. Now, franchises are across the board, depth-wise, getting stronger. Springbok Rugby seems to have unbelievable depth at the moment. But yet, every now and again, we hear bleating from across the hemisphere about how certain countries don't want us in the European competitions. We keep on hearing about amalgamation of the URC and the Premiership that's being mooted as well. Just where do you guys stand on all of that?
Well, first, we were very fortunate that we could go north after Super Rugby failed and folded and became a specific New Zealand-Australian competition again. And the URC has been good to SA Rugby, but again, SA Rugby is good to the URC. You talk to anybody that's in the URC, the teams, the administration, the Irish Rugby Union, the Welsh, the Scottish, the Italian Rugby Union, they all say that the best thing that could have happened to their competition was the fact that South African teams entered in the competition. So there's no negativity within the family of URC whether South Africa should be part of it or not part of it. Where there were question marks was the EPCR. Remember when we joined the EPCR and through URC qualified to play in the EPCR? There were some noises from journalists in the UK, out of France, saying, yeah, but this is a European competition, South Africa doesn't belong there. You know what? I think the longer we continue, the less noise is coming from those quarters. If you talk to the EPCR organization and their management, they are exactly on the same boat as URC. The huge difference the South African teams made to the competition, the excitement around the competitions. So I think we are now fully integrated in URC. Through that, we qualified to play the EPCR, and I do not see that change in the formidable future.
Would you consider, and it's been fantastic to see South African teams measure up against those top European sides, but would you concede that it is a bit of a difficult one in terms of the branding, how you put this thing together? That's always been a European competition, and now you have these giants from the south part of it. Would something have to happen on that front to sort of make it, give it a bit more of a global feel and flavor?
I don't know. If you look at when we started URC, we were all confused. We, as South Africans and the public, we didn't know who we played against and who is the Dragons and who is the Ospreys. I think now we're in season three now, and I think people, the South African public now understands the competition better and buy into it a bit more. And it will happen with the EPCR as well. So, you know, we tend to forget this is our third season in this new structure, and it will take a while to settle down. So I'm not concerned about any uncertainty within our support base, whether it is a competition we should play in or not. You will see the benefits for the South African team. You mentioned it yourself earlier on, and the depth of players coming through. And you all also start hearing out of New Zealand and Australia where they start saying, yeah, we might have made a mistake not to have South Africa there anymore. So I don't think it is it's a negative for us playing in URC. I think it is a positive, and I think the more we settle in the competition, it's a new competition. I think international boundaries is just that. It doesn't, and it shouldn't change the competition itself. Whether we're from the south playing in Europe shouldn't make a difference. It is the quality of the competition and the support that you get out of the competition that's important.
Sorry, Ryan, I just want to return to what I asked. These stories about the Premiership wanting to join with the URC, is there something firm there, or is it just talk, or is it just media reports, or where do you guys stand on that?
Well, there was a discussion between URC and the Premier PRL, Premier Rugby League, about looking at a competition where the best of the two competitions can play against each other. It is talks at this moment in time. Nothing has been confirmed yet. Whether we can fit it in and whether it can work and what will happen to an EPCR then, those are things that still hasn't been resolved. So it talks at this moment in time, and I don't think there's anything more to it now.
Okay.
Well, we should probably let you go. I know you're a very busy man. I want to thank you for, again, making yourself available. What I have to say is that with you in charge of SA Rugby over the years, You've never been scared to answer the difficult questions, and thanks for always availing yourself. So thanks for coming on to our show, and good luck with all these loose ends that need to be tied up at some point.
Thank you so much. And you know what? We're also busy with all nonsense. We forget that our Springboks are going to play again in a week and a bit's time in the UK, and hopefully come back undefeated. And in the end, that is where we are here, really. You know, we have to look after our product. Thank you for having me on the show. And then to all your followers, thanks for being such great supporters of rugby and the Springbok team. We really appreciate your support. Thank you.
Rian, just from my side, thanks as well. And I echo what Liam says. I think we're going to have you back at some point, hopefully when this equity deal is sorted out. And then we can maybe talk a bit also about, because one of the things I think in the future, which is going to probably come up, is a succession plan for Rossi, because he can't coach forever. I know we all want him to coach forever because he's done so well for the box. But at some point, I think we're going to address that. I know you guys have got plans in place for that, but it'd be great to talk about that at some point.
Thank you, Brendan. Thanks for having me.
Cheers.
Thanks. Yes, so there we have it. I think he answered as much as he could. You know, I've never found him one to sort of duck and dive. I mean, when you call and there's a difficult question to be asked, he usually answers his phone or he gets back to you. And yeah, we pretty much saw that now in this interview as well. He tried to answer what he could.
Yeah, it's a tough job to be in because obviously on his side, he has to look after SA Rugby, and that means everything from the amateur sport to all the smaller unions, to the professional franchises. And obviously there's always competing sort of viewpoints there the whole time. I think at the end of the day, he's got a track record. He's done well for SA Rugby in the past, and he's back again and he's doing, I know he does have detractors, but at the end of the day, I thought it was great for him to just come on and face the questions. And I may have put it a bit blunt to him at times, but I think good on him for doing it. And he said he'll come back, so we'll have him back again in the future, and hopefully it was worthwhile listening to.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we need to move on, and we mentioned the fact that there's no rugby this week, because last weekend saw the round six of the rugby, United Rugby Championship being played. It was round five for South Africa's teams, and the log has a bit of a familiar look, certainly in the top three. As things stand, of course, the competition will resume at the end of November. You're not entirely shocked by what you've observed so far, Brendan, after six rounds?
No, just a couple of thoughts on that round. And I know I'm not going to be quite popular with some of the fans, local fans, for saying this. But first of all, I think Glasgow's win against the Stormers was very bad for South African teams, the challenge, because Glasgow are not going to really lose games that often in the rest of it. It's going to be hard to keep them out of the top two. It's always been the case with Leinster. And now that you have two teams that are going to be vying for their top two, it's going to make it a bit harder for our teams to get into the top two. So I thought that loss was a very bad one for the South African cause across there. And plus, you feel there's something wrong. Yeah, I had a chat with our friend Gavin Rich about it as well. And we both sort of agreed that there seems something a bit off with the Stormers at the moment. They love to play that helter-skelter rugby, but a team like Franco Smith's Glasgow Warriors are organized. They know what they're doing. They know what to expect, and they sort of prepared for it, and they played them very well. Sometimes the Stormers try too much on those sort of no-look passes and Hail Marys and things like that. And when they come off, it's beautiful to watch. But other than that, it's as we saw this weekend, it can go quite against you. I was disappointed with the Lions. I know I'm very different. I've taken a bit of flack on the weekend after this. Because while a lot of people said they were very brave in holding the incident to that score, the whole week they spoke about firing a shot. And then they didn't fire any shots. And they just defended.
Yeah,
and I felt, you know, if you're going to talk about yourself of being a top four side like they've done this season, and you want to compete in that top four, it's you guys are telling us that, then you have to fire shots. You have to do those sort of, you know, yeah, even if you lose at the end of the day, but yeah, do something. Their attack was nowhere in that game. And I think that's what disappointed me, especially because the Lions are a momentum team, a team that loves to attack. And we almost saw nothing of that in that game. Bulls were lucky. They didn't play well, but they found a way to win. And the Sharks, the box, definitely made a difference. And as we've seen, Graham Rountree's now departed Munster, which was a bit of a surprise to us. But that's in a nutshell my thoughts of the weekend.
Yeah, well said. I also thought, I mean, the Stormers game, they were very disappointing. But kudos to Glasgow, a team that, in terms of their game management, is almost always spot on. They didn't quite get it right the week before, but they take mature decisions most of the time, and they know what they're about, and they play to their strengths. And I think intelligently coached by Franco Smith. And I think you're right. They're going to be difficult to catch. You know, the deeper you go into the competition. The South African teams, in the case of the Bulls and the Lions, a couple of points off, they have a game in hand. But, I mean, geez, that's going to become a bit of a marathon later on.
Yeah, no, definitely. Of course, there's one game this weekend, Liam, that we should mention, because already I see there's people like Joe Marler trying to get himself into the media by saying the Harker should be banned and all this stuff. Isn't this what happens every time England comes up a big game? One or two of their players goes in for something sort of a bit ludicrous, makes a lot of headlines. I don't know if it's them or, you know, maybe their media contingent that sort of blow it up. But New Zealand have been preparing quietly, and this is going to be an epic clash on the weekend at Twickenham. I think New Zealand might just put up a show that England might be a bit worried about.
Yeah, I don't, you know, while Marler in bringing up the Haka, I don't think anything is sort of that sacred that you can't talk about it. I think, it, you know, it's probably worth bringing up and bringing into a debate, irrespective of which way you feel about it. So I don't think we should say that Marler shouldn't talk about it. But it's interesting that he chose to, because it will fight up the All Blacks, there's no doubt. So probably not the wisest thing to have done. And we'll see how that plays out. I mean, I would be, you know, if I was an All Blacks fan, I'd be quite bullish about this game. I think if we look back at Six Nations, where England's form's a little up and down, they had some good ones, but they also had some iffy ones. All Blacks didn't win the Rugby Championship this year. So there are questions to be asked there. But I think they have more going for them than England. And I think the last thing that Marler should have done is sort of getting their backs up.
Yeah, he certainly waved a red flag in front of them now. And I mean, that's all the team like the All Blacks quite needs, because they get very, and let's be honest, we all know a couple of New Zealanders, they get very touchy when you talk about the Haka. They find that it's sacred to them. And you understand why once you know the culture there, et cetera. But it's certainly something that will be mentioned in the team talks. It's certainly, and England, you know, when they're down in New Zealand, they played well in those two tests against the All Blacks, but they didn't win. And they missed an opportunity there. So they'll probably feel, yeah, back at home, now's our shot to get them. But, yeah, if you're the All Blacks, you've lost two games against South Africa. You've lost one against Argentina. That's already being seen as a bad year. The pressure's on them to do it well. And after this, they've got Ireland and France. So they can't afford to lose this game at Twickenham. So it just makes it for an intriguing clash. But I wouldn't be surprised if we see the All Blacks sort of use that motivation to their advantage.
Yeah, I see them coming out firing and getting the job done. I mean, they are walking a tightrope on this tour, because it can, if it goes wrong up front, it could be quite devastating. So I think they'll be very careful to avoid that.
It's going to be a fascinating week, and not to the Springboks, of course, but next week we'll have them play Scotland, and that's when the real tour starts. So we'll be back then. I hope you enjoyed this episode. We always try and bring you the most up-to-date stuff. But please tell your colleagues, friends about this podcast. And it's always good to get new people listening. But thanks for listening.
And cheerio.
Thanks for listening. For the latest insights and rugby analysis each week, plus new episode alerts, please follow or subscribe to the series. Or find all episodes at jacaranda.fm.com or the Jackpot app.